Hi, everybody, and hi, Alana, and welcome to another episode of Hard Truth.
Hi, good David.
To see you again, Alana.
Good to see you. Yes, we have an exciting guest today.
Well, we have, actually, and we got a lot of ground to cover, as is always the way. But suffice to say, before we get to that, just a gentle reminder to all those who watch this that what we need you to do, guys, and we're going to be watching you, make sure you hit that subscribe button underneath. Make sure you share all this stuff out so we can get important voices like our up-and-coming guests and get these views out there, and so you can have a broader perspective. I think, Alana...
Besides, David, in the spirit of the time and the protest, we know where you live, so subscribe.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. We are the anti-disinformation people on this platform. So, and of course, we call it Hard Truth. And actually, I think, Alana, it's really appropriate that for the interview we're going to do, you know, facing reality rather than indulging frivolous fantasy is what we're all about here, really, isn't it? And that's what we're going to tackle.
Yes, David, I love you. Let's get on with it.
I love you back. Right. Okay, Alana, let's tell everyone about our special guest.
Yes, we're going to bring in Nebojša Malić. He's a Serbian-American journalist, blogger, and translator. He wrote a regular column at antiwar.com from 2000 to 2015, which is where he and I met, and is a senior writer at RT. I personally have known Nebojša for close on 20 years as a principled anti-war libertarian and historian of his birthplace, Serbia, which of course means a Russian spy. Let's meet the gentleman.
Hello.
Hello. It's good to welcome a Russian spy onto the platform. Thank you so much for being with us this evening. Good to see you.
Good to see you both.
So, Alana, shall we open up on this one?
Yes. The floor is yours, David.
Okay. Well, I think, look, essentially what we want to chat about is, and kind of extend the conversation, is you wrote a really interesting article, which I think we can also bring up on screen. Western media clubs together to whitewash Ukrainian neo-Nazis. And as you say in this one, multiple outlets use the same talking points, quotes and experts to whitewash Ukraine's notorious Azov regimen. So maybe just to kick off, kind of summarize what your main points in this article are, please, Nebojša.
Sure. So basically, I noticed a pattern. Pattern recognition is one of the things that I've been doing for years, so it wasn't really that difficult. But I noticed a pattern in Western media coverage, specifically British media coverage, yeah, of Azov in Ukraine, starting about 3-4 weeks into the escalation of conflict, so mid to late March, that showed them using the same phrases, same catchphrases, same talking points, quoting the same people to talk about Azov. And basically try to explain that, no, see, they're not really Nazis. The whole Ukrainian Nazi thing is a Russian propaganda. Sure, there might be some people with some symbolism here and there, but, you know, this is ancient pagan symbols. They're not really Nazi symbols. It's only tangentially related to Nazi Germany. And besides, you know, shut up and stand with Ukraine type thing. And, you know, the quote expert that they quote in this business is a Ukrainian who lives in Vienna, and his entire career is saying, no, there are no right wingers in Ukraine. There are no Nazis in Ukraine. Russians are real Nazis. That's his entire shtick. That's his grift, so to speak. But what struck me as even more interesting is that whichever member of Azov, and they inadvertently showed the extent to which this unit, that used to be a former unit, has infiltrated the Ukrainian military at large, is that no matter which member of Azov they spoke, whether it was in Mariupol, which was at the time still in communication and they still had a presence there, whether it was Kiev or somewhere else, they all recited the same talking points, the same exact language. you know, Russians are real Nazis. We're fine. We're heroes of Ukraine. We you know, we're not nationalists, et cetera, et cetera. You know, nationalism is different from patriotism. We're patriots, et cetera. They all gave the same canned responses, and all of these reporters, ostensibly from different outlets, ate it all up. And even more to the point, they knew exactly which buttons to push because they were talking to a British reporter, a Financial Times one, outside of Kiev, and they were like, oh yes, those British in-laws, they work wonderfully. They're superb. Send more of them. So they knew exactly how to approach these reporters. And the crucial cynical argument that they've all made, not the Azovites, but the reporters, is that it was one of the semantic games. They don't have any formal power. And that formal is doing a lot of heavy lifting. Because yes, on paper, Ukraine is a democratic country with a democratically elected president called Volodymyr Zelensky, who's of Jewish heritage, and therefore they can't possibly be Nazis. That's how the mainstream argument.
Well, how come the Southern Poverty Law Center calls me a Nazi? And I'm Jewish.
But see, Ilana, do you give 10% to the big guy? Because Zelensky does, and that makes him immune from that.
Yeah.
Right. So here's the thing. When they... That formally does a lot of heavy lifting because, again, for a battalion, they are officially known as regiment, but they're not even a regiment. They're basically the Ukrainian equivalent of the SS. And I'm not just saying that because of symbolism, but because when they started out in 2014, right after the coup, the US-backed coup, which thumbed its nose at Europe to try to negotiate an actual democratic solution to the protests, they were set up by an overt, avowed neo-Nazi, Beletsky, who created their symbols based on Nazi symbolism. He deliberately picked out the Black Sun, the mosaic from Himmler's castle. He deliberately picked out the Wolfsangel, which was used by one of the SS divisions. They deliberately used the Totenkopf, which was used by another SS division.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so it has the Wolfsangel has nothing to do with Ukrainian heraldry. Nothing whatsoever. You could argue that the Trident does, and it's got some troublesome historical associations from World War II. But okay, you could make an argument that the Trident is a legitimate national symbol. But the Wolfsangel is most definitely not. And Beletsky testified, he openly bragged about this to Time magazine back in 2014, which I also bring up in the article.
Yes, you do.
This was before the whitewash, that, you know, this is what I intend to do. These are the statements he made as a head of, I believe it was called the National Front or some other organization similar in name, about a, you know, crusade against the Semitic Untermenschen in Europe. You had Bellingcat, of all people, that laundry service for the British intelligence, criticize Ukrainian Nazis as late as last year, mentioning Beletsky and his associates, mentioning their base, etc. And yet, all of a sudden, everybody's marching in lockstep and saying, oh, yeah, don't pay attention to any of this. This is irrelevant.
Yes. And this that's they persecute people stateside, at least in our country, insisting that perfectly nonviolent people are the greatest danger and domestic terrorists.
Well, I'm not even going to get into the whole, you know, Trump is inciting insurrection when he says fight like hell, but when a Democrat senator says that, or when a mayor of Chicago says this is a call to arms for a war we intend to win, that's perfectly fine. That's a whole different level of hypocrisy that we can do a whole nother episode about U.S. politics lapsing into civil war. I've written about that too.
I like it. Yeah. I mean, but the thing, look, the thing about it, Ilana, that fascinates me as well is that, you know, in the article, you know, it's pretty clear that the British media, you know, the media that I sort of surrounds me has been instrumental in the whitewashing of this clear, overt Nazi pedigree. And, you know, it shocks me, Ilana, that that Britain seems to be the epicenter of this, and then it goes across to the States, and then the talking points are repeated there.
There's a cross-fertilization of garbage, isn't there?
Well, yeah, but it's worse than garbage, I think, because it's pernicious. It is sanitization of some. I mean, the Azovs. I mean, they're not. They're pretty blatant. I put it to you. You
know, absolutely.
Okay, guys, I'm going to throw a wrench in this, as you
go for it.
Imagined I will, but Nebojsa will have the answer. So I like that Elon Musk has brought back a term of speech we love, and that's the free speech absolutist. So for me, I, as a libertarian, and you're a hardcore libertarian as well, I distinguish clearly between what are persecutions and nagging based on thought crimes, insignia, things people say, as opposed to palpable actions that would indicate harm and violence. And I must say that, obviously, you know, and you lay it out quite clearly, but in your article, I did not see any evidence. Yes, there was the 2014, declaration of the Jews and being against all the traditional Nazi enemies, but I did not see any overt violence that the Azov perpetrate against the traditional enemies of Nazism. I saw paraphernalia, insignia, and so on, more a sort of belief system. So the problem for me is twofold. First of all, it seems like they're white nationalists. There's no doubt about it. I find it ironic that our side, first of all, that preaches freedom of speech. I don't mind what your beliefs are, so long as your myths stop at my face, right? Our side that preaches freedom of speech also is going at the Azov. To me, they seem maybe as the only positive thing that is happening in Ukraine, because they are Ukrainian nationalists, whereby whatever we see about Ukraine is so Americanized, is so radicalized, is so Jacobin. I mean, I see the Ukrainian people really drifting towards an American satellite state. And if these people are standing up for the Ukrainian nation and they're not perpetrating violence on the same populations that the Nazis went after, that's my problem. So go for it.
Okay. That's provocateur as always. I love it. So I didn't dwell in the article itself on the Azov atrocities, because that would have taken a book. And we had a bit of a time constraint on there. But you've no doubt seen, so Azov actually has been involved in violence against the Roma community, the Gypsies, as they're also known. But they have, there is a gentleman who is not the head of the Jewish community in Ukraine, but a major public figure by the name of Dolinsky, who's been documenting their overt Nazi-style attacks on Ukrainian Jews for years.
Oh, really?
As well as, but again, these are, so we have to distinguish between people who are LARPing as Nazis, the folks who dress up in uniforms and you know, Sieg Heil, and you know, attend funerals of the members of the Galician SS, from Azov. Because Azov goes a step beyond that. They were specifically set up. So when the war in Ukraine began in 2014, quick run through your timeline. February, there's a coup in Kiev that overthrows the government, and these U.S.-backed militants, John McCain's spiritual children, take over.
Yes.
And one of the oligarchs who's backing the new government, Igor Kolomoisky, whose base was in the city of Dnipropetrovsk, which has been named to Dnipro since, who also has an Israeli citizenship and is actually currently, I believe, in Israel because he fell out with the fellow oligarch Poroshenko since. He was the one bankrolling both Azov and Zelensky. Azov was one of his early pet projects. He was funding a militia.
And
he's Jewish. Well, so again, this is one of those weird.
Actually, does it support my perspective? Maybe not. I mean, we have Judenrat also kind of sold the Jews out.
But so Kolomoisky is basically using Azov as one of his private militias. There were several. There were multiple of these battalions, regiments, whatever. Idar was the most notorious one that was operating in the Donbass, but they got destroyed in one of the skirmishes and actually disbanded by Poroshenko's government because they were marauders. And Tornado, another notorious unit, was also jailed eventually because of the violence they were perpetrating against Ukrainians themselves, not just the people in the Donbass. And then they were all released from jail recently by Zelensky and sent to the front. There is an actual conspiracy theory that Zelensky's ordering all of these nationalist battalions to fight to the death in the east and get killed by the Russians so they wouldn't threaten him anymore. Sort of a second order conspiracy. I don't know how true that may be, because they're inferring his motives from his actions.
The relationship between Zelensky and the Azov?
So they had a major showdown in late 2019 at a village called Zolotoy. This is a checkpoint facing Donbass, the two republics that seceded after the coup in the east. And he was basically out there to supervise the ceremonial withdrawal of heavy weapons in observance of the Minsk protocols. The Minsk protocols were the ceasefire that was brokered by the French and the Germans to end the fighting after the second catastrophic defeat of the Ukrainian forces in February 2015. And according to this agreement that froze the conflict, the Ukrainians and the Donbass forces were supposed to retreat to a certain line and then engage in negotiations. But every time the government in Kiev tried, whether in good faith or not, you'd have Azov and all these other veterans of the anti-terrorist operation, which is how the Ukrainians styled their war, basically either gather outside of the government building in Kiev with guns or confront Zelensky himself. And this is what happens. This big group of Azov fighters came to the village and said, "We're not leaving. You try to force us to leave, we will overthrow you. We will fight you. You will have a civil war." And he's like, "Well, I'm the president. I'm issuing you an order." And they basically told him to bugger off.
Yeah.
And so after that confrontation, Zelensky completely abandoned even a pretext, because he was officially sworn in on a peace platform. He said, "I will do anything for peace in Ukraine." But after that confrontation, he had zero influence over the nationalist militias led by Azov. And from that point onward, he's making a hard turn towards confrontation.
But the other thing I would throw in is that, Alana, to your point about Azovs, I mean, my problem with the Azov...
David, answer me this, because you also know, nobody knows what Nebojša knows. I mean, the guy's an encyclopedia of the region. But it so far seems to me Azov symbols are Nazis, but their actions are... nationalist.
But here's the other thing.
Hang on. I just want to come in on this.
Okay, David.
Just let me come in on this one. As far as I can understand, from 2014 to now, essentially Azov have been the cutting edge of what appears to be me to be a semi-genocidal attack on the people living in the Donbass, the 4 million odd Russian people speaking in the Donbass. So therefore, to me, that kind of qualifies them to me as being pretty Nazi-like, you know, seeking to wipe out or certainly do as much destruction as they can to a group of people that they don't like, who predominantly distinguished by the fact they live in southeastern Ukraine. What say you, Nebojša?
So the thing to understand about Azov from the Russian perspective is that they might not be the reincarnation of the National Socialist German Workers' Party.
Yeah.
Symbolism notwithstanding. But they have the same exact position towards Russian speakers and Russian ethnics as the Nazis did in World War II. Extermination. I appreciate what you said about Ukrainian nationalism, and I've heard plenty of discussions over the past 2 months.
There are Ukrainian nationalists who are intent on keeping the Ukrainian character, which... This is another thing that is absolutely submerged in the political and prostitute press amongst the politics, is that Ukrainian is white.
That's the thing. The Zelensky government. So my personal position, based on everything I know, is that there is the same fundamental issue in modern Ukrainian nationalism, the one that's been prevalent in Western Ukraine, and I'm not talking about the West, I'm talking about the regions that had been part of the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth back in the day, and even Poland proper up until World War II, that, and before that, part of Austria-Hungary, that share the same mind virus, for lack of a better term. And I know this is imprecise, and I know we're going to get heat over this, but that's the best shorthand I can come up with. As the Croatian nationalism in the former Yugoslavia during World War II, yeah, the one that was allied with the Nazis, and the same one that's been in effect since 1991, the Bosnian Muslim nationalism since the Austro-Hungarian occupation, and there's this Austro-Hungarian ethnic engineering gene, so to speak. Basically, the court in Vienna encouraged these identities to form with their blessing, because these were up until the late 1800s, these were all conquered people with no rights. Modern day Croats, Bosnian Muslims that got occupied in 1878 after the Congress of Berlin, and present day ethnic Ukrainians who lived in Galicia and all of these regions that were that Austria-Hungary acquired during the third partition of Poland. And in the late 1800s, the Austrian government has this plan to create anti-identities. So they nourish a anti-Serb concept of Croatness based on Catholicism and militant Catholicism in present-day Croatia. In Galicia, they set up this anti-Russian Ukrainian identity. Mm. The flag, the blue and yellow flag, was a flag of an Austrian regiment. It was a regiment serving the Austrian military, drawn from that area. And then in Bosnia, they had a prominent anthropologist who had previously authored a book describing the inhabitants of Bosnia as Serbs, basically spit on his own words and invent this Bosnian nation as a way of ethnic engineering, as securing Vienna's hold on these provinces. Well, it didn't really amount to much at the time, because, of course, by 1919, Austria-Hungary is gone. But it left the seed that later blossomed into the Ustasha government in Serbia, which was absolutely genocidal towards primarily the Serbs, but also Jews and Roma, committing atrocities that made even the SS blush, because they considered them too... The Germans prided themselves on being very clinical and technical and technological about killing, and these people preferred to kill with knives and axes.
Industrial killing.
Right. And you had followers of Stepan Bandera during the war in the Soviet Union, who went after the Poles and the Jews. You had the grandfather of the current Deputy Prime Minister of Canada was a Nazi Ukrainian propagandist who took over a Jewish newspaper and turned it into a pro-Bandera, pro-Nazi outlet. And then he fled and surrendered to the British after the war and was evacuated to Canada. That sort of stuff. So again, they're not spiritual heirs of Hitler so much as heirs of this negative nationalism that was promoted by Austria-Hungary as an anti-Russian, anti-Serb, etc. And they're simply carrying out that script, believing it is the genuine Ukrainian nationalism.
You see, some people would say, though, like, people argue, I've had arguments with people about them in terms of, are they neo-Nazis, for example? But see, I don't think they are neo-Nazis. I actually think they are literal Nazis. But, that's what I think.
But again, when it comes to treatment of Russians, it's a distinction without a difference. Because if you believe that Russians are subhuman orcs that need to be exterminated and Russia partitioned, and, you know, greater Ukraine is the Lebensraum of the true white race, which some of their ideologues believe, then you were functionally a Nazi. And if you're using German World War II SS symbolism while doing it, then what's the difference?
That's my point. That's how I see it, Alana, you know.
Allow me to address Alana's final question. There was a lot of chatter early on in the conflict from people who were like, well, you know, why would we oppose the Ukrainians? They're white nationalists. They're fighting for the white race, et cetera, et cetera. I've been sort of looking left and right at this, watching all over the political spectrum for reactions. And you had people literally argue, look, they claim to be white nationalists, and yet they fight for a regime that's entirely beholden to the World Economic Forum, IMF, the yeah. same globalist cabal running the West, you know, gay pride parades and all this other stuff.
Well, there's the contradiction in your position and David's, isn't it? I mean, if they are on board with multi-culti globalism and that, then they're not nationalists, they're not Ukrainian nationalists. So what's the objection?
Well, and that's the thing. They're not genuine Ukrainian nationalists. They're Nazis. One of the things we've seen over the past 30 years, since the end of the Cold War, is that the globalist Western establishment, however you want to define it, is perfectly fine working with literal Islamic jihadists, first in yeah. Bosnia, then in Chechnya, then in Syria with ISIS, yeah. Before ISIS sort of got off the chain and became inconvenient. But even then, it was Russia that had to put it down because they were hoping to use it for regime change in Damascus. But they were also in bed with literal Nazis. Again, with Croatia comes to mind when Richard Holbrooke writes in his memoir that, you know, don't be squeamish. These are our junkyard dogs. They're not squeamish at all about supporting these you know, you have the Baltic states holding their annual SS marches every year, actual Nazis. And that's fine. They're Democrats because they're members of NATO and they can be used against Russia.
The other thing to challenge you about is that I went back to the Putin's address to the nation where he speaks about the empire of lies. And I believe none of our side has read it. The portion about the Azov, not Azov, about Nazism is minute. Mm-hmm. And in fact, we have, as you know, we have a complete blanket on this speech, which is actually brilliant. The speech is brilliant. He lays out, what does he say there? He says, primarily the eastward expansion of NATO, which is moving its military infrastructure ever closer to the Russian border. And he delineates the whole, what Stephen Cohen brilliantly put in, the cold mind mindset towards Russia, yeah. never permitting any relent in this Russophobia and not permitting a detente to take place. So he and minute section of this very, very thorough and intellectual speech to the nation, to the Russian nation, he mentions these Nazi elements. So haven't we really blown this out of proportion?
So yes and no. Do you remember in the American Declaration of Independence that line about the King of England allying with merciless Indian savages? It's one of the points that they list as the train of usurpations.
Yes, yes.
It was referring to King Philip's War, in which there was a rumor that the crown was considering allying with the Indian tribes behind the Ohio line to suppress the colonists. And the atrocities from King Philip's War, a generation behind, were still fresh in their minds. And they were like, okay, no, this is a complete betrayal. We counted on the crown to protect us, and they're going to deliver us for genocidal purposes to these merciless Indian savages. There's been objections to the Declaration of Independence, and they've actually censored it under the current government. It's been tagged in the National Archives as objectionable text because of that line, among other things. But nobody would in their right mind argue that the American War for Independence in 1775 and 6 was fought because of that line. No, it's one of the lines in the long trains of injuries and usurpations. Just like as you mentioned, the line about Azov and the Nazis in Ukraine is one line in Putin's speech.
Yeah, but, literally.
And it's not its pivoting point. That's what I'm trying to I think we're all
the whole edifice of yeah. Putin as an insane man. That speech is brilliant. It's actually
he is not fighting. Russia is not fighting in Ukraine.
It's pure geopolitics. That's what
Russia's not fighting in Ukraine because of Azov. Russia's fighting because Azov is a manifestation of the collective West taking over a Nazi position towards the existence of Russia. Functionally the same. They're just symbolism.
I can't help finding that unpersuasive. Yeah. And that's why I don't even think that he really didn't emphasize it. Where has this emphasis, this impetus with this Nazi thing?
He doesn't have to.
Sorry, I think it's fair to say, Alana, that, I mean, Putin did talk about one of the justifications for the military incursion, invasion, whatever you want to, however you want to call it, was the denazification. His words, denazification of parts of Europe. He did say that, you know. So, but I also agree that, you know, look, what, and Alana, you recall, you and I, way back in January, we were preaching the gospel of, you know, war is really bad. We do not want to be getting into this. NATO needs to stop pushing. But NATO wants, like, let's be honest, NATO wants war. NATO had its biolabs across Ukraine. NATO's been wanting to do this for quite a while. So, you know, you're right. The Nazi thing is, it's not all being, we shouldn't hold everything around the Nazi thing. Mm-hmm. But if there are Nazis in this, some people might say maybe they're to be found in NATO.
Well, again, Ilana's got a point. This is geopolitics. And it's just that, let's be clear. When folks in the West talk about Nazis, and that means people we dislike, that is a word at this point completely devoid of meaning. Most people who in the West who say Nazi, that's what they mean, people I dislike. This is not the usage in Russia.
Yeah.
The Russians are very specific. They're both referring to the original National Socialist German Workers' Party and Hitler, but also to a doctrine, to a almost religious belief about Russians and the need for their extermination from this world that the Nazis championed and tried to carry out. And when you have Western officials and journalists and ambassadors and you know, openly saying Russia should be partitioned and broken up so that it never threatens the West, civilized West again, and these people are subhumans, they're orcs, they need to be destroyed, they're only validating that premise. The whole point of, and again, in my perception, what Putin said in that speech was the West has been using Ukraine to get at Russia for years.
Yeah.
And again, you have these Western
NATO is just a proxy for the United States.
Absolutely. And again, you even have Westerners admitting this by saying, well, you know, we're trying to depose Putin by creating a prosperous European democracy in Ukraine that will show that his concept is invalid. Well, first of all, that's abject nonsense because Ukraine is not a prosperous European democracy. It's a failed state, a failed puppet state by any measure. And Putin is not endangered by Ukrainian democracy. Russia is threatened by Ukraine being an armed outpost of NATO, or rather, you know, globalist American empire.
You and I, as libertarians, we always differentiate between civil society and the state.
Correct.
Ukraine is a failed state, but when you see the people, especially the villagers, there's a lot going there, isn't there?
And that's the most soul-crushing part of this.
Because my whole question to you, and you've answered me emphatically, is maybe Azov has a feeling for that dispensation, the Ukrainian people. You don't think so? Yeah. Okay.
No, because the true expression of civil society in Ukraine, the little battalions, were those people in Odessa who got burned alive in the trade union building, who were protesting the coup in 2014, in May 2014, which the Azov wasn't a thing then, but the Maidan nationalists who behind it had run them into the building and set them on fire. It was the citizens of Mariupol who peacefully held a vigil to objecting to the coup, and then the Ukrainian government, the new regime, sent tanks against them, which they tried to stop with their bare hands but couldn't.
To what extent, Nebosha, has Ukraine been lost to the American idea of an ideal satellite democracy? To what extent? Is it totally a satellite state of the United States?
Ukraine in its current incarnation, the territories controlled by Kiev, are absolutely a puppet state of the American empire, with a twist that President Zelensky at this point has been promoted to this kind of
deity.
Right, it's the opposite of scapegoat. I think we need to have a
new word.
And going back to the Bible, a leader that won't negotiate. If he and Biden, if Biden is capable, picked up the phone to Putin, high-level negotiations, that's what a leader does When do you think the Ukrainian people will turn on this man who's reveled in his status rather than pick up the phone and say, please stop bombing my people?
Well, the reason Azov exists so is that they never do. They're basically the enforcement arm of the government.
Here's a point as well, though. You know, we've talked a lot during this, and we're going to have to come to an end shortly. But we've talked so much about Azov, and I understandably so. But I mean, some people would say, listen, this is a puppet, a failed puppet state, with this actor pretending to be president, and he does whatever he's told. NATO is fighting Russia to the last dead Ukrainian. Mm-hmm. And so, frankly, you know, if Ukraine was razed to the ground from a NATO point of view, so what? So what? They'll have achieved their objective. They've got Russia involved. They've got parts.
Right. And how is loving your nation having, you know, basically having it exterminated in a proxy war for a globalist empire? That makes no sense.
Yep. Yeah,
the thing about Zelensky as the anti-scapegoat of this entire business is that I've never seen this kind of entitlement since Bosnia. The last politician I saw making demands of the West as Zelensky, and no, it wasn't even that bad, was the Bosnian Muslim leader during the war, Izetbegovic, who was, you know, the West owes us because our existence is something, something, something. But he was never so brazen as to say, you know, give me $7 billion a month to pay my salaries and pensions. And Zelensky flat out says, you know, you owe me this money. You must pay me.
Yeah, but
nobody owes you anything.
Okay, listen, it's all okay. Bono has visited Ukraine. Bono has sung a song with The Edge. Everything's going to be fine.
And that's how I know this is Bosnia 2.0, because he pulled the exact same stunt in Sarajevo as well. Well, I'm getting PTSD just from being reminded of the same script that I lived through 30 years ago.
Yes, we want to have you back to make the connection between Serbia, because you say it's a precursor for this war. And I think it's very important, especially with your grasp of the history. One last thing, and then I'll see to David. I want to ask you, as a libertarian, there's so few of us hard right libertarians around, is what I say about this war. Putin, there are plenty of reasons for this war, and all of them are heavily weighted towards the Russian side. Putin is in the right. There are reasons for this war. But as a libertarian who follows the non-aggression axiom, as I know you do, there's no justification ever for a war of aggression. Over to you on that.
I'm in agreement to this. I absolutely agree with this. I have issues with the way this special military operation, conflict, war, call it whatever you want, commenced. Because again, had we gone through the proper forms of Canley, as the movie quote goes, it would have followed that, you know, Russia recognizes Donbass as independent states. Ukrainians attack, they invoke a mutual defense treaty. Oh, no, actually, that actually happened. They invoked a mutual defense treaty. So if you're looking at forms, if you're looking at protocols, they were kind of sort of observed. It's just that the whole, you know, this is a completely unprovoked invasion of Ukraine is one of those narratives that was literally deployed from the get-go. Would the Russian government, could the Russian government have been better at articulating its narrative? Yes. I'm not entirely a disinterested party in this because, again, I worked for RT at the time.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were completely caught off guard by this. I can freely admit this.
Really?
Nobody told us anything about this. We were as surprised that this started as anybody else.
Yeah.
But had they observed Western forms, they would have said, look, you know, this is a war that's been going on for 8 years. We're finally intervening in it because these independent states we just recognized have formally asked us to intervene to protect their people from extermination, responsibility to protect whatever you want to address it as. The fact that Putin articulated the historic argument for the war but didn't necessarily bother to make the Western argument for it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, he did do that in his speech, but you are right. It's deficient.
He did not bother with the Western narrative. And what I took from that is that he knows, and since then, Foreign Minister Lavrov and others have said this is a proxy war with the West and has been all along. They knew perfectly well that the kinetic conflict in Ukraine was only one level of the conflict that's going on between Russia and the collective West, in which Ukraine was just a pawn on the board, a bit player, a sacrificial lamb, call it whatever you will. But the people of Ukraine, the Western governments never intended to help the people of Ukraine. Had that ever been the case, they would have overthrown the government.
And the worst part, David.
Sorry, Alana, just on that one there. That one point I would make is that I think we're probably all in agreement here. Basically, I think NATO, which is the US, they led the bait, and they, very, very particularly, and Putin took it, did he not? And
yes,
but if I put myself in his position, it's really difficult because it's so outrageous what NATO have been up to in Ukraine, so bad. But put it to both of you, actually, if you'd have been Putin facing all that we know, what would you have done different? First of all, you, Nebojsa.
Nebojsa.
I would have, again, thanks to my bias working in the media all these years, I probably would have tried to articulate a slightly catchier narrative, but substantially in terms of statesmanship, I don't... based on what I know now, I don't think I would have done anything substantially different. No.
Alana,
I think he tried just as much as the only document to emerge, Nebojsa, if you remember, from the Iraq war that was a truthful document, was a assessment of the weapons of mass destruction, zero, put out by one of those clownish, the people, the Fox News bimbos laughed so hard at, that clownish foreign minister, whatever it was, the Iraqi. He put out a very thick document saying, this is what we have, none of it justifies war. That was the only, truth that came out of that war. And I think the same will transpire with Putin's, casus belli, cause for war. However, it is very hard to justify assaults on civilians. So that's the problem for libertarians.
But it's hard. It's also hard to let genocide go by, idly by, when the people being genocided in Donbass
are civilians.
Essentially, your own people.
At one point I wanted to make is that you will notice that there, even the Ukrainian propaganda recently hasn't harped on quite as much. They've used some Bosnian templates to claim massacres of civilians, but you're not hearing numbers of dead civilians lately. That might change in the coming days, again, in service of a propaganda narrative.
Nebojsa, the culture of lies that Americans, the Anglo-American culture, is not aware of, although we are specialists in the big lie, of course we are. We actually, at the point of a bayonet, create parallel realities which we force the world into. But certainly there's a lot of intricacy in terms of the propaganda, the Ukrainian propaganda machine. And I'll just end by saying, to me, Zelensky is the biggest criminal of it all, because he's a star. I'm sure he's heavily protected by special ops, American probably, not Azov. But and he can't pick up the phone and say, please just negotiate, diplomacy, real politics, something that, get old Kissinger in, he would do a better job.
But the point is, he's not allowed to, because he is literally a marionette, being with all the strings being pulled from Washington, all the propaganda being run out of the media centers in London. You know, it's a tremendously horrible situation that's developed there. And I thought my final point is just to yourself, Nebojsa, Russia lost millions and millions of lives fighting Nazis. What's it like to have the Western media basically say, yeah, Putin's Hitler, and by the way, the Russians are Nazis? I mean, it's back to Alana, it's alternative reality being invented.
It's insult to injury. It's insult to injury, and the Russian people, by and large, have noticed this. Don't think they haven't. And the whole dream of, if this war fails, Putin will be overthrown and Russia will become a Western democracy. Yeah. Whoever came up with this, I want some of what they're having, because that's some industrial level of hopium that hasn't been generated in nature. What came from a Wuhan lab or something?
What's Putin's approval rates in Russia? In Russia proper, is it about 80% or 70%?
Yeah, it was something like 84% last time his critics checked.
Yeah,
so more than double that of Joe Biden.
Yeah,
although
yeah.
admittedly, that's not exactly hard.
No.
So, this has been an absolute treat, and we definitely must have you back again to speak about Serbia and connect it to the. You've written very interesting pieces on the connection between Serbia as a precursor for this type of war. Thank you for coming on with us.
Thank you for having me.
Hope to see you again.
Likewise. Thank you very much, Nebojša. Yeah. So if we can then just wrap things up, Alana, between you and I, really interesting session there.
Fascinating, yes. A lot more to expound on in the future.
Yeah, and the thing is, you know, we're trying to encapsulate hard truths, and this is a tapestry of intricate issues which needed a bit of time to be talked about. So I think we've tried to give it as much time as
we
possibly.
And we couldn't have had a better... expert to come and speak to us about.
It's been an absolute pleasure to have Nebojša on. So listen, I think we need to wrap things up at that point. So thanks everybody for watching this. Remember, subscribe, or Alana and I are going to be coming around to your door checking up on you, and we'll see you again, folks, this time next week. That's it from myself.
Bye-bye.
And from Alana. Bye.